On today's show, the emotional arms race, how our anger works for us and works against us. Anger as a burden, as a weapon, and as a creative force on Stay Human. Stay tuned. That's a new release from The Weight Band, In the Heat of the Moment. I'm Michael Goldberg. The kind of anger that flashes suddenly, that's always hot, but it generally burns itself out fast. And even though it's often regrettable, the way I figure it, it's not really worth regretting. It's just reflective anger, triggered maybe by somebody getting angry at you, or by seeing someone you love being disrespected or treated wrong. We get angry. We can't help it. We get angry and we should, and then we move past it and we should. Maybe it is worth regretting that kind of anger, though, in this sense. When we notice our emotion, then we can start to see that we feel a lot of different kinds of anger at various times in our lives and in different circumstances, very different kinds of anger with very different consequences. There is this reflective anger in the heat of the moment, but also there's attached anger. Consider road rage. Ever been a passenger in a car driven by somebody who basically is mad at all the other drivers? That's not a fun trip. That kind of anger, that's all about ego. Attached anger because we've made the anger part of our identity. We can't let it go because we think it's a vital part of our self-respect, our defense against attacks on who we are. Attached anger, though it does flare up, it isn't hot like reflective anger. It operates more like exactly at body temperature because it's part of the baseline from which we perceive everything. A lot of people bring this attached anger to work with them if they don't get along with coworkers, and you can see how in any kind of circumstance it can be hard to shake. It feeds on itself. Or it won't go away even when you think you've forgotten about it. More than 40 years ago, I invited my old high school buddy Tom to come visit me and my girlfriend in our little apartment in Somerville, Mass. I could see right away that Debbie liked him. We'd been living together for over a year, and she agreed with me that he was a funny and fun guy to have around. And as his 3 or 4 day visit continued, I started to think he was a lot less fun. In fact, I started to get angry at his overconfidence, his jokes and put-downs at my expense, the way he took over the living room and the kitchen. By the time he left, I had heard the last smart or snarky remark I ever wanted to hear from that guy. It wasn't until after he was gone that Debbie told me that he and she had, you know, done it in the living room while I was out on the last afternoon, and my humiliation was complete. But here's the thing that makes it still interesting to me all these years later. Though I was hurt, I didn't really feel angry at her. Now I'm not sure why, but all my anger was reserved for Tom. And Tom, if you happen by some miracle to be listening to this now, I want you to know, don't contact me. I want nothing to do with you. You were planning to go to medical school, you said, and would make a lot of money. However it turned out, Tom, I hope you're miserable now. You deserve to be. Attached anger. In that case, it's not doing me much harm, and it's no danger to anyone else. But that kind of anger that shields us from perceived threats to who we think we are, that's the anger that poisons the well and spreads out from the house to the job, from the town to the next town over, from one person to an imagined category of people. I've been thinking, you see a lot of anger out there, and it becomes a little less scary, I mean, a little easier to understand and deal with it, if you look at your own angers, especially the ones you're so attached to you don't even notice or automatically justify when you do notice. So I wonder, what triggers my ego-attached anger? And what can I do with that? And how much of it, I wonder, like my long-ago anger at Tom, how much of it can I just let go?
Well, my mind. He's done evil. I've done evil too. Oh, my man, he's done evil. I've done evil too. Oh, my man, he's done evil. I've done evil too. But I'm gonna wait right here, see what my daddy gonna do. I'm standing.
You stay with me until you drag me down.
That's Adia Victoria working some changes on an old blues tune, Evil Hearted Me. That's another new release here to Northern Community Radio. With support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, this program features people telling their stories. And I'm always up for hearing yours. If you'd like to talk it over or share something on this program, write to comments@kaxe.org and put Stay Human in the subject line. I'd love to hear from you. Among our contributors to this program is Anne Marie Erickson, sharing excerpts from her forthcoming memoir and essays, In the Evening We'll Dance. I admire Annie and her writing for many reasons, and not least for her clear-eyed honesty. Here's her piece called That Is Not Becoming of You.
This essay is about anger. Mine. It's not becoming of me. It's a report, a detached dispatch from the field. I must be honest, which means I must be humble. For it's humiliating to tell you about my anger, anger directed at my husband, a man who was drowning in dementia. I'd told people that writing about anger's fervor and spark would be fun. Then October blew in, the month of his death. His body now ash, leaves withered, berries hung frozen on their stems. And memories of my anger became a yoke biting into my neck. When he was alive, I'd avow my anger. It was antithetical to resignation, passivity, defeat. Now I regret it. The root of the word anger means sorrow. Regret originates from an old Norse word, grata, to weep. Sorrow and regret underlay my words like the notes of a threnody fitted to lyrics. This telling is a form of penance. I had reason to be angry. Every night for years I'd slept lightly, ears alert for a rustling of the sheets, a creak in the bed frame, body attuned to any movement on my husband's side of the bed. Whenever he got up to go to the bathroom, I too arose. Barely awake, I'd grab his hand and lead him there. Throughout the day, he'd repeat the same question moments after I'd answered it. Who lives in that yellow house next door? Or when are we going home? Or what day is it? Over and over, I'd reply, Todd and Debbie Godfrey, or at 4 o'clock, or Tuesday. It tried my patience. I'd search for his misplaced glasses or his lost dentures, which he'd hidden in the garbage, the log pile, the plastic bag where I'd stowed my down jacket. They have to be here somewhere, I'd yell. What the hell did you do with them? He'd remain silent. My exasperation seethed around him. Often I'd shout because I felt that I was not being heard by him or by others. The author Ursula Le Guin says that she speaks so passionately because, as the only girl with three older brothers, she often only could be heard by shouting. Learning how to be heard taught her persistence and gave her a tendency to appear fiercer than she is, concludes Julie Phillips in a New Yorker interview. Like Le Guin, I learned persistence. Unlike her, I often was as fierce as I appeared. I'd slam doors, pots, and pans. I'd pound my fist. I'd curse. Feeling unheard by medical staff when Dick needed a referral, I swore, hung up, and threw the phone halfway across the room. Amazingly, it didn't break. A partial list of objects I broke in anger. A ceramic cup, a glass dinner plate, a wooden salad plate, a framed photo of Dick and me. The full-length mirror that hung inside our bedroom closet door, the one I never used. It came crashing down when I slammed the door shut. It's evidence, leaning against the garage wall, waiting to be hauled to the dump. The cardboard backing has caved in from moisture. It mocks me. So much anger and pain. Let me pause here for a moment to collect myself, to look out the windows at the sun, to leaven my heavy heart. But tell me, did I have reason to be angry? He'd shit on the toilet seat, the floor, my hand. He was oblivious. I cursed. He asked me, "Why do you use those words?" "Because I'm angry. That's the language I use when I'm angry." "Well, that's not becoming of you." Later, I'd apologize for losing my temper. "You did?" He usually didn't remember that I'd done so. We're counseled to forgive and forget. He'd already forgotten, so there was nothing to forgive. I have not forgotten. Forgive me. Dick had a litany of swear words he'd use in anger. "God damn it, effing son of a bitch." It had a jagged rhythm, the chugging of a locomotive as it picked up speed. I believe that a woman has every right to swear if it suits the situation. Cursing is not the sole preserve of men, as if some boundary existed between the male realm of expletives and some ladyland, the domain of decorous language. Dick had agreed with me. So who was this self-righteous man chiding me, "That's not becoming of you, and we don't use language like that"? Who was this royal we? Who was this stranger? At times, my husband became wasi-wasi, unpredictable and disoriented, a term used by the Mabuti people of the Congo. They envisioned a sphere that surrounded each person, moving with and protecting him or her. However, people would become wasi-wasi if they moved too abruptly in time or space. They'd arrive at the sphere's boundary before the center had time to catch up. And according to the anthropologist Colin Turnbull, if a person actually pierced that boundary, he or she might be replaced by someone else, possessed by an imposter self. Dick's imposter self chided me for my curses. He'd momentarily turn into a stranger, an unknown person. Some say that the person with dementia isn't the person he or she once was, as if the body is still there, but the mind has been lost and replaced by another who now resides in that body. This is sometimes described in terms of a stranger. It also could be called being possessed. Only there's no exorcism that can cast out the demon dementia. 2 years before Dick died, I dreamed that he was in bed with me, facing my back, nestled. I felt his warmth, his body pressing against mine, a feeling I'd loved. He wrapped both of his arms around me. Then he held my wrists. I couldn't free my hands. I pleaded with him, please let go. Let go of at least one of my hands. I panicked. He was holding me too closely, too tightly. Let go, let go. Finally, I woke. I wondered if I'd receive a call from the assisted living facility that he had died. I doubted it. I'd asked him to let go of only one of my hands, not both. I left the light on the rest of the night. I didn't want the dream to return. Even though I thought it was Dick next to me, the fear was of a stranger. Forgive me, for I was afraid of this stranger. Days of chaos supplanted our pleasant, ordered life. The man I'd known for decades changed, grew erratic. I seldom could reason with him. He was at times irascible, resistant, or intemperate, yet no longer able to ask for forgiveness. He used to be the first to do so. It's not intentional, it's the disease. It's not intentional, it's the disease. It's not intentional, it's the disease. Dementia burns all the bridges. There's no going back to who he was. It takes a long time to truly inhabit this idea. It takes a long time to realize that you're the one who has to change. He can't. It's the disease. Forgive me, for I did not know. We'd entered uncharted territory. Living with dementia is an irrational experience, as the writer Pauline Boss points out. It's an absurd condition in the sense of being discordant, out of harmony with reason. Dementia is, she says, uncanny, strange, and unsettling. The uncanny makes us uneasy. Dick made some people uneasy. They didn't know what to say to him. They said being with him was difficult. He was different, not himself. They'd step away, grow detached. I wanted to scream at them, but instead I explained, cited research, told stories about his surprising or amusing remarks. I had little sympathy for them. I wanted to shake them, rattling their bones to reveal the hole behind the rib cage where their heart was supposed to be.
Thanks to Anne-Marie Erickson. You're tuned to Stay Human on KAXE KBXE. Thank you. The Turtle Island String Quartet, with some music written 300 years ago from The Four Seasons. In her essay, That's Not Becoming of You, Annie Erickson quotes Ursula K. Le Guin, who died in January 2018 after leaving us with a wealth of wisdom, mostly in her fantasy and science fiction books, her preferred science being the social sciences. Her parents were well-known anthropologists, and Le Guin turned an anthropologist's eye on our own society by imagining other worlds. She also wrote a lot of criticism and essays, including her searchingly honest essay about anger. She says that anger is a surface eruption, a response to feeling vulnerable and powerless, which, let's face it, friends, all of us finally are. Le Guin reasons that when anger is a defense against perceived threat, it comes from fear. She says, if I'm in an angry mood and I'm aware of it, I can ask myself, so what is it you're afraid of? That gives me a place to look at my anger from. Sometimes it helps me get into clearer air. I think most everyone can see their own anger if we're honest about it, and we all see the anger rising around us. And it is directly linked, for sure, to feelings of powerlessness. Anger has its uses, but Le Guin argues that continued beyond its usefulness, anger becomes unjust and then dangerous. Nursed for its own sake, valued as an end in itself, it fuels regression, obsession, vengeance, self-righteousness. The way I look at it is this: anger is a weapon. A weapon is a tool, in this case, a tool designed for combat or self-defense. A tool has its own logic and makes its own demands of whoever would wield that tool effectively, and there's a lot of weapons being waved around these days.
Up this morning and his eyes are heavy, so he shakes his head, gets out of bed. Nothing different so far, but things can change, yeah. You know, he lost his job, his ex-wife's a slob, and he's got no friends, so he goes to his den to get his gun. Knows that it's there, hasn't seen it for years, but it's there just the same. Now there's another
face in the valley,
in the hand of a man from Van Nuys. Wasn't raised to harm no one, but it just got tired. Now there's another
face in the valley,
and it just don't seem right. There's one more piece in the valley. Now he's walking around, he remembers this town. Damn, it used to be safe. If it was civilized here, it's gone without a trace. Things can change and they do. Yes, they do. But it feels better right now than it has in years. Maybe he brushes right by you, smiles and combs back his hair, caresses his jacket. Yeah, that gun feels right, like it's always been there. Another
kiss in the valley.
Yeah, in the hand of a man from Van Nuys. In one short day's gone from nothing to the keeper of another life. Now there's another
kiss in the valley.
And it just don't seem right. There's one more piece in the valley tonight, yeah. One more piece in the valley
So far, there is no date set, as far as I know, for the U.S. military parade the president ordered the Pentagon to put on later this year. They're still working on it over at the Pentagon, have to decide how much to spend, $3 million, $10 million, $30 million for a spectacle befitting the president's intentions. If you're going for tanks and jets and marching soldiers up Pennsylvania Avenue, might as well go big, I guess. It's not a veterans parade. We do that just about in every town in America at least once a year, some places several. No, this one is to be a fully televised parade of weapons, waving them in the world's face. Of course, since about a week after the parade was announced, the weapons on everyone's mind are the handheld variety, specifically semi-automatic rifles. Been hearing about them a lot. The reaction to the school shooting infuriates those who seek to change our laws and those who define the issues as liberty versus regulation. There's plenty of anger to go around. And as far as I can tell, all sides see their opposition as deluded and or dishonest. Those who attack the logic of the call for regulatory change, and there's so many different kinds of statistics that get thrown around, there's all kinds of ways to attack the logic, they direct their anger at those who, they believe, threaten their liberty. The party of unlicensed liberties versus the party of government control. Since the recent mass shooting, public opinion has been, as it has for about the last dozen years, evenly split, with about half the country opposing and about half supporting some kind of ban on semi-automatic weapons. But it's interesting that when there was such a ban on the books, a much larger majority, up to 2 out of 3, supported the law. When that law was allowed to expire in 2004, and about since then, public opinion has been more evenly split for or against. Public opinion, it seems to me, more often reacts to policy than determines it. Unless, of course, that public opinion is not just a matter of opinion because of how deep it reaches, how obvious the threat, how widely felt the consequences. It's an opinion that's got the passion and the determination of social movement, and that's when the changes happen. Whether you're talking about the fight to legalize the rights of labor and labor unions, or the fight to end sexual harassment, it's fueled largely by anger, crystallized to outrage.
They say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call
BS!
They say a good guy with a gun stops a bad guy with a gun. We call
BS!
They say guns are just tools like knives and are as dangerous as cars. We call
BS!
That's Emma Gonzalez, a senior at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Florida.
I watched an interview this morning and noticed that one of the questions was, do you think your children will have to go through other school shooter drills? And our response is that our neighbors will not have to go through other school shooter drills when we have had our say with the government. And maybe the adults have gotten used to saying it is what it is, but if us students have learned anything, it's that if you don't study, you will fail. And in this case, if you actively do nothing, people continually end up dead. There has been one tweet that I would like to call attention to. So many signs that the Florida shooter was mentally disturbed, even expelled for bad and erratic behavior. Neighbors and classmates knew he was a big problem, must always report such instances to authorities again and again. We did, time and time again. Since he was in middle school, it was no surprise to anyone who knew him to hear that he was the shooter. Those talking about how we should have not ostracized him, you didn't know this kid! Okay, we did! We know that they're claiming that there are mental health issues, and I am not a psychologist, but we need to pay attention to the fact that this isn't just a mental health issue. He wouldn't have murdered any students with a knife!
Gonzalez addressing a rally a couple of days after 17 of her classmates and teachers were killed. Angry. Anger is a weapon. A weapon is a tool to coerce your enemy or protect yourself. A tool has to be understood and treated with respect if it's to do its job. The students who stormed the Florida State House, who are staging die-ins, and the students all over the country who will participate in a national school walkout, those students will be getting a whole lot of education in a concentrated dose. Education on how to use their weapons and how to respond to power. Whatever the near-term outcome, a lot of them, like their brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, fighting beside them against brutality and against domination, daring to imagine the world as it could be, a lot of them will be radicalized by the experience, seeing the ways that power holds its grasp, coming to understand the connections between all of the struggles for human dignity and human worth. And I hope that someday they'll look back as I do and be able to say, well, we were wrong about some things, but not about everything. And the world has changed, and it won't stop changing. Anger is the lens that can show us what needs to be done.
Un para todos y todos para uno.
March! March!
Let's go.
King of my city, king of my country, king of my homeland. King of the filthy, king of the fallen, we living again. King of the shooters, looters, boosters, and ghettos popping. King of the past, present, future, my ancestors watching. King of the culture, king of the soldiers, king of the bloodshed. King of the wisdom, king of the ocean, king of the respect. King of the optimistic and dreamers that go and get it. King of the winners, district and geniuses with conviction. King of the fighters, king of the fathers, king of the belated. King of the answer, king of the problem, king of the forsaken. King of the empathy and resentment, king of remorse. King of my enemies, may they fall defeat, I rejoice. King of the skyscrapers, dodging haters, broke religion. Nine faces, go against them, I erase them with precision. I embrace them with collision. Kings did it, king's vision. Black Panther, King Kendrick, all hail the king.
I dropped a million tears. I know several responsibilities put me here. I don't pedal backwards, but I live old-fashioned. The lens that I'm looking through won't prescribe you the right glasses. Masses are now free. Ashes I'm dumping out, about to spread all across seas. Sisters and brothers in unison, not because of me. Because we don't glue with the opposition, we glue with peace. But still a fuck up your organization. If any beef, what do you stand for? Are you an activist? What are your city plans for? Are you an accident? Are you just in the way? Your native tongue contradicting what your body language say. Are you a king? Are you joking? Are you a king? Are you posing? Are you a king? Are you smoking bull rocks to keep you open? Because a king don't cry, kilo die, kilo like king. If all king get by kingdom, for kingdom come when I come, you know why.
King, 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 king.
I am T'Challa.
That's Kendrick Lamar with the theme song from the Black Panther movie. Went to see it on opening weekend. I am a regular tourist in the Marvel Universe, and this is one of the best. Obviously, it's just a movie that isn't just a movie. It's an event. Carvel Wallace wrote a great piece about it, published the weekend the movie opened in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. He calls it a defining moment for Black America. He says it's the first time in his life that he's ever bought tickets in advance for a movie. And he writes, "Here in Oakland, I am doing what it seems every other Black person in America is doing, assembling my delegation to Wakanda," including some of his oldest friends, their kids, and their kids' friends. "The film arrives as a corporate product," he says, "but we are using it for our own purposes." It's an event, all right. And 100 years from now, if we're lucky, historians will be working at the event into their stories about how race changed in the 21st century. Also, it's just a movie. You might not be into superheroes, I don't know. But I had been thinking already about anger, and it struck me that the storyline, not the overall effect of the movie, not its message or certainly its meaning as a cultural event, but the thrust of the plot line itself comes from rage. The character's first solo comic book was called The Rage of the Black Panther. This was in 1968 when the poster of Black Panther Huey Newton and images of angry, armed, determined young Black men and women in their black berets, those images were burning into the American psyche. 1968 was an angry time, kind of like 2018. Anyway, this is not an angry movie, but its supervillain who challenges the superhero Black Panther for the throne. He is fueled by rage, and not only over the murder of his father. He's enraged by the injustice of the African diaspora and by the 1,000-year decision Wakanda has made to keep itself, its power, and its pride a secret from the world. Joining and leading the world is what the king's closest friend has urged him to do, and his future queen has chosen to live outside Wakanda in order to help alleviate the suffering of others. So, the supervillain's rage at some level becomes ours. If you can bring light to the world, how dare you refuse? We never are actually rooting for the villain, but we see his point. Things have got to change. That rage has to go somewhere. In blockbuster movies and everywhere in popular culture, rage is a destructive force and a creative force. Mayhem and murder are what's needed to take the story where it has to go. And here in the real world, I don't believe we can disavow our angers. a few enlightened individuals, maybe, but I really can't picture humans overall giving up anger, laying all our weapons down. What we can do, what we need to be able to imagine, is choosing our weapons carefully and recognizing that they're just one set of tools among many. We need them all. There's plenty of work to do. Here's another cut from the Black Panther soundtrack. Kendrick Lamar and company with a song called All the Stars. Thanks to Anne-Marie Erickson for being part of today's show, and thank you for tuning into Northern Community Radio. Stay Human is heard every week at this hour. My name is Michael Goldberg, and taking us out, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers.
Yeah.